So Psalm 37, you remember, is exploring the believer's situation when the wicked around him are prospering. And in particular then, it's highlighting four areas, and we considered the first of those last Sunday evening in verses 1 to 11, namely the believer's attitudes. And we're going to continue then this evening with the other three areas highlighted. And first of all then, the believer's God. The believer's God. And this is verses 12 to 26. So what then is God doing as the wicked prosper? Well, David points to three things. First of all, God laughs. God laughs. So last week, as I've just said, we considered the believer's attitude as the wicked around him are prospering. And we said that attitude is summed up in those two words that are found in verse 1 and in verse 7 and in verse 8, fret not. That is the believer's attitude. As the wicked around him prosper, the believer is to fret not, or in the more positive terms of verse 7, is to be still. But what about God then? Is he fretting as the wicked in this world prosper? Well, he's certainly not, is he? In fact, his composure in the face of the wicked prospering goes beyond merely being still. His composure is nothing less than this. He laughs. That's what verse 13 tells us. The Lord laughs at the wicked. That's how unperturbed he is. And he then is unperturbed for the same reason that the believer is to be unperturbed. Remember, one of the things we focused on last week was this, that fretting for the believer is short-sighted. It's a short-sighted reaction. When you see the wicked around you prospering, to fret about it is short-sighted, because in fact the wicked's prosperity is a very, very fleeting thing. It's only temporary, it's only for a moment. And that then, in verse 13, is why God laughs, David says. He laughs at the wicked, for he sees that his day, that is the day of the wicked being brought down, he sees that his day is coming. And there's something reassuring then about this concept, isn't there, of the Lord laughing. I apologize for all these transport illustrations today, but if you're in a plane then that's preparing to land in stormy conditions, what is going to reassure you is not the composure of that guy who's sitting on the other side of the aisle and who doesn't seem to have a care in the world in this situation and is sipping his coffee and munching on his crisps quite happily. That's not going to particularly reassure you, because for all you know, that guy might be the most naive nincompoop ever to fly on an aeroplane. Now, what's going to reassure you is the composure of the pilot as his voice comes over the tannoy. And there's not so much as a tremor in his voice. And he's not telling you to get into the brace position. And he's even cracking a joke about this terrible British weather. His composure is going to reassure you, because at the end of the day, he's the one responsible for landing that plane. And similarly then, God is the one responsible for bringing about that day, which in the language of verse 9 will feature the evildoers being cut off and those who wait for the Lord inheriting the land. Remember, we said ultimately that's not talking about a little land in the Middle East, Israel. Ultimately, in the full biblical storyline, it's talking about the new heaven and the new earth, the renewed creation. God is the one responsible for bringing that day about. And presumably then, if he in heaven is composed, if he's laughing, then everything's under control. Everything's on course. That day is indeed going to come about. It's not in jeopardy. It's not touch and go. It's not tenuous. It's going to happen. Yes, that wait referred to in verse 9, it might be proving a fairly long wait because it still hasn't happened yet. That day hasn't yet come, but it will come. If God, the one who's going to bring it about, is laughing, then everything's fine. He is going to bring about that day. So God laughs, but then secondly, God knows. God knows. What does God know? Well, you can easily answer that question for me, can't you? God knows everything. And that, of course, is a sublime thought, isn't it? That God knows everything. You'll have heard those famous words by the eminent scientist and mathematician Isaac Newton as he was reflecting on his career. This is what he said: I was like a boy playing on the seashore and diverting myself now and then, finding a smoother pebble or a prettier shell than ordinary, whilst the great ocean of truth lay all undiscovered before me. And of course, 3 centuries later, the great ocean of truth is almost as undiscovered now as it was then, isn't it? Still, most of the workings of this massive universe are not known to us. But they're all known to God. There's not so much as a puddle of undiscovered truth lying before him. He knows everything about every detail of this entire cosmos. But while that then is, as I say, a sublime thought, actually what often delights the psalmists is not so much that God knows everything about the universe, but rather that God knows everything about me. And you might say, well, surely that's a vastly less impressive thing. It's vastly less impressive for God to know everything about me than for God to know everything about the universe. But you see, the point is that God is interested enough in me to know everything about me. That's what so astonishes the psalmists. If David Cameron were to appear on Mastermind and choose as his specialist subject the kids' TV program Teletubbies, then we would say, wouldn't we? Well, surely that's beneath the dignity of the Prime Minister to know so much about Teletubbies. And you might have thought it would be beneath the dignity then of the creator and sustainer of all things to know so much about me, to know so much about you, to know so much about tiny little individuals. But you see, unexplainably, God has set his affections on me. He's made me the object of his eternal love. And out of that love then flows this attentive, concerned, passionate knowledge of all the details of my life. That's what particularly delights the psalmist. Not his knowledge of everything, but his knowledge of everything about me. And David here then delights in that. And in verse 18 then, he applies it to this situation, the believer surrounded by the wicked who are prospering, while he, the believer, is not prospering. And he says there then in verse 18, the Lord knows the days of the blameless. In the second half of that verse, he returns to the more familiar territory of this psalm. And their heritage or inheritance will remain forever. There again, he's directing our gaze to that future, that inheritance of the land that is coming the believer's way, and there particularly emphasizing the everlasting nature of that inheritance. But you see, in the first half of the verse, the Lord knows the days of the blameless. He's saying that even in the present, Even before we take possession of that eternal inheritance, even while our days are difficult, surrounded by the wicked who are prospering when we so often are not prospering, even now there is this consoling reality. The Lord knows those days that we are living through. The Lord knows our struggle and our situation in all its details. He's not out of touch up there in heaven. He's not hopelessly removed and cut off from our day-to-day struggle. He knows, he's aware, he's not indifferent. He sees, he takes it into account, he's interested. That's what David is saying. So, God laughs, God knows, but then thirdly, God upholds. God upholds. David uses that phrase twice. In verse 17, the Lord upholds the righteous. And verse 24, the Lord upholds his hand. And this means then that even when the economic disparity between the righteous and the wicked is at its greatest, God never lets it become so bad that the righteous do not survive. That's what David is saying. The Lord upholds them at that most basic sense. He keeps them alive. He keeps his people. Even though his people may often in this world be poor, materially poor, compared to the wicked who are prospering, nonetheless, the Lord keeps them alive. Now, there's a helpful realism about David in this psalm, and he qualifies that divine upholding in a couple of important ways. For one thing, notice it is survival we're talking about here. Verse 25, I have been young and now am old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken or his children begging for bread. So God gives his people enough to at least keep them off the streets begging. It might not necessarily be much more than that. That's not promised. And even that basic provision may at times seem touch and go. So verse 24 refers to though he fall, and it's not their moral falling. It's talking about calamities and crises and really serious difficulties coming his way, which might seem even to threaten his very survival. Even then, the Lord does uphold him, and he does, just about by the skin of his teeth, survive. That's what David is saying. He may only have little, verse 16, better is the little than the righteous, than the abundance of many wicked. But the Lord does keep his own fed and sustained. And then the other qualifying point to notice here is that the Lord then upholds his people in this way using means. And especially then he uses, it seems, their generous giving to one another. Because that's stressed, isn't it? In verse 21, the righteous is generous and gives. Verse 26, he is ever lending generously. And so we mustn't glamorize then this divine upholding. We mustn't romanticize it, but we must recognize it as a real thing. Perhaps you can testify to it yourself. There have been points in your life when things have been pretty tight economically, and yet you've survived. God has given you each day your daily bread. Perhaps at times it's been not much more than that, but he's given you each day your daily bread. And so I'm saying then, this is what God is doing as the wicked are prospering. He's laughing because he knows what the future holds for them, the wicked, and for his own people. He knows the difficulties involved in living in a wicked world for his people. And he upholds, he keeps his people alive and sustained at the most basic level. The believer's God. Secondly this evening, the believer's behavior. The believer's behavior. This is verses 27 to 31. And so we said last week then that another of the reasons why the believer doesn't fret in this situation when the wicked are prospering is that fretting is morally unhelpful to the believer. It easily leads the believer to sin. And it's to that note then that David returns in these verses, starting with that clarion call in verse 27, turn away from evil and do good. The believer's behavior, in other words, in this kind of situation is to be counterintuitive. Intuitively, seeing the wicked around you prospering, intuitively that leads to frustration and to self-pity, and then that leads to lashing out in all kinds of reckless misconduct. But David is saying the believer is to be counterintuitive and instead is to do good, verse 27. Or in the language of verse 31, is to have unslipping steps. And here now, we are talking morally. We said the falling, pictured in verse 24, is simply trials and calamities. But of course, here in verse 31, we're talking about the believer's steps not slipping morally. Which raises the question then, how? How, under that kind of stress and provocation, when the wicked are prospering and the believer is struggling, not prospering in this world's terms, how is the believer's behavior going to remain so steadfast, so full of integrity? Well, David says by means of a focus and by means of a fact. First of all, by means of a focus. You see, what kind of doing good does David have in mind? Well, doubtless doing good generally. But notice there's a special mention, isn't there, in verse 30, of speaking justice. If you jump back to verse 21, you notice there that this interesting little detail that the wicked are not necessarily prosperous despite being wicked, but sometimes are prosperous precisely through being wicked. They're borrowing but not paying back, being dishonest and fraudulent, being unjust, in other words. And in such a context then, when we see others prospering through being unjust, the temptation can be to emulate that and for ourselves to start to be a little bit dishonest in our own handling of things. And perhaps that's why then the stress here in verse 30 is on justice. This is the kind of doing good which especially David is saying you must, the believer must practice in these situations. The believer must continue committed to justice. And it's very important then that we notice the word connection here between verse 30 and verse 28. Because back in verse 28 then we've been told something about the Lord. What? That he loves justice. And now we're told that the believer then, his tongue speaks justice. I think that's significant. There is a book, a children's book that you can buy called Ryan Giggs' Soccer Skills. Now, it may be that Ryan Giggs has all kinds of literary flair and the ability to explain things that I know nothing of, but I reckon that probably if you want to have a hope of playing football, even remotely like Ryan Giggs, probably a better way of doing that than reading his book is to get a whole stack of videos of Ryan Giggs playing football and to watch them. It's the kind of thing that's better caught than taught, as we often say. And there's perhaps a similar idea here then. How are we going to get justice into our bones as Christians? How are we going to get justice into our bloodstream? How are we going to be deep down people committed to justice? Well, I think David is implying by focusing on the God who, verse 28, loves justice. It's one of the great functions, I think, for us as New Covenant believers of great chunks of the Old Testament law. You think of a passage like Deuteronomy 24. In Deuteronomy 24 we have commands like this, verse 6, "No one shall take a mill or an upper millstone in pledge, for that would be taking a life in pledge." So in other words, if you've loaned money to somebody and you're taking a pledge from them that they will pay back, don't take their upper millstone, because that will remove their source of livelihood. They can't continue to grind, they can't continue to produce anything if their upper millstone has gone, and so don't take that, take something else as a pledge. Or later on in that chapter, when you make your neighbour a loan of any sort, is verse 10, "You shall not go into his house to collect his pledge. You shall stand outside," and that's not to humiliate this man who is indebted to you and is having to borrow from you. Verse 12, "If he is a poor man, you shall not sleep in his pledge. You shall restore to him the pledge as the sun sets, that he may sleep in his cloak." So if you take his cloak as the pledge, then make sure you give it back before the end of the day when it'll get cold and he'll need that cloak to sleep in because he's a poor man. And you see then, again and again here, it's pointing us to the careful justice of God, isn't it? Who is concerned for the details of justice in the way that his people conducted themselves. Now, I mean, we could spend hours trying to find one-to-one modern-day applications for those things, and we'd probably fail. We don't deal in millstones and cloaks as pledges. We don't sleep under cloaks to keep us warm at night. But surely the point, rather, is that we stand back and say, wow, what a God. What a God who is so concerned for justice, for the rights of the poorest and the most neglected, that he would come up with all this kind of legislation. That's the point of passages like Deuteronomy 24 for us. And it's as then we react like that and we say, wow, what a God of such justice. It's as we focus on this attribute of God that it begins to kind of seep into us, and we want to become like this God who's been revealed in passages like that. And so I'm saying then, how are we going to be those who, under provocation and under stress, do good? By focusing on God, by being God-focused people, because it says we focus on him, that by his spirit, his nature, his character starts to seep into us by means of a focus, but also then by means of a fact. Look at verse 31, that great statement, "The law of his God is in his heart." In other words, the believer then, he has the law of God kind of deep down shaping his behavior. There's an unanswered question though there, isn't there? Which is this: how does that law get there? How does the law of God get into this believer's heart? We have similar language just a couple of psalms later, Psalm 40, where similarly, verse 8, the psalmist talks about God's law being within my heart. But again, no explanation. How does it get there? Does the believer put the law in to his heart? Well, it's the New Testament, isn't it, that will finally answer that question. It's Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 3, where he talks there about the Spirit of the living God having written on, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of human hearts. Now, what's that an allusion to? When did God write something on tablets of stone? Well, on Sinai, of course. What did he write on tablets of stone? The law. And if then the Spirit writes not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of human hearts, presumably the content of what he writes is the same. It's the law that once was on tablets of stone. And Paul is saying, in conversion, in regeneration, to use the fancy language that we use sometimes, the Spirit then writes God's law on our very hearts. It's he who puts it there. And that's a great fact about every one of us. If we're believers tonight, we have the law written on our hearts. Of course, Paul elsewhere says that in a general sense, a vaguer sense, all people have the law of God on their hearts, in the sense that it's in their consciences. But this is something quite distinct from that. Every believer, by the Spirit at regeneration, has God's law written on his heart. And that means then that we are wired up from conversion to do good, even under stress and provocation. Doesn't mean it's effortless, but we can do it because we have been wired up by the Spirit who has impressed the law on our hearts. And even then, when the wicked are prospering and we are not, we can still not lash out and respond inappropriately because the Spirit has put the law in our hearts. And so let's then focus on God so that we'll catch something of his own character, and let's also simultaneously be persuaded of the fact that we can be good, we can obey God even when things are tough. We can, because the law has been placed within our hearts. So the believer's God and the believer's behaviour, but then thirdly and finally, the believer's faith. The believer's faith, verses 32 to 40. Let's just return then, as we close, to this theme which pulsates throughout the psalm. This theme of God's people inheriting the land. And as I've already said this evening then, remember, the ultimate meaning of that concept, you have to go to Jesus on the mountainside as he teaches his disciples, and he says in one of the most well-known utterances that there has ever been in history, "Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the land of Israel." No, they will inherit the earth. The land has become the earth. This promise in Psalm 37 is finally fulfilled in all the people of God taking possession of the very creation itself, renewed, freed from the curse, and wonderfully rejuvenated. But there's a tiny problem that emerges in verse 32 of the psalm. And the problem can be expressed in a single word that we find there: death. Death. That verse talks about then the wicked actually watching for the righteous and seeking to put him to death. And I don't think we're to read that merely as a kind of potential thing that the wicked would like to put the righteous to death, but it's saying that sometimes the wicked do put the righteous to death. And of course, even if the wicked don't put the righteous to death, death's going to happen anyway. If the wicked don't get us, illness will get us. Something will get us. We shall die. And that raises the question then, doesn't it? Well, if we're going to die, how are we going to inherit this inheritance that Psalm 37 is promising, that Jesus is promising? How are we going to inherit the earth if we're going to end up dead? Well, the answer, I think, is suggested in verse 33, the next verse, which reads, "The Lord will not abandon him to his power." I wonder if that rings any bells in your minds. There's a definite allusion there, I think, to an earlier psalm, Psalm 16, where we have, not just in the English but in the Hebrew, identical language. And there in Psalm 16 then, and verse 10, David says, "You will not abandon my soul to Sheol," i.e. to the realm of death. And that probably then is in view again here in verse 33, that yes, the wicked may put the righteous to death, but the righteous will not be abandoned there, will not be left there. The righteous will be brought back from there. Psalm 16 is clearly one of those Old Testament passages pointing to nothing less than full bodily resurrection. And Psalm 37 then, using the same language as Psalm 16, is probably also pointing forward, pointing ahead to that. And it then throws a whole new light, doesn't it, on subsequent phrases. The next verse, verse 34, wait for the Lord and keep his way, and he will not just cause you to inherit the land, but will exalt you. There's that kind of vertical movement implied there. Exalt you to inherit the land. Will exalt you from what? Exalt you even from the grave where you've ended up. You've been killed, you're dead, and yet he will exalt you even from that low, apparently unreachable and impenetrable position. He'll exalt you from there so that you will inherit the land. And then you come down to the last two verses. And this emphasis then on the Lord as Savior, as Deliverer. The salvation of the righteous is from the Lord. He is their stronghold in the time of trouble. And now we begin to appreciate that this salvation is even salvation from Sheol, from the grave, from death. The time of trouble isn't just some little crisis, it's even the ultimate trouble, it's death. The Lord helps them and delivers them, yes, even delivers them from the ultimate disaster of death. Now it's radical enough, isn't it, to believe at all that the righteous will inherit the earth. But it's even more so then in the face of death coming first. And you're in your 80s or 90s and you know you can't have much longer left. Or you're younger than that, but you've been diagnosed with some terminal condition and you haven't got all that long. It requires quite some faith, doesn't it, then? When your body is starting to shut down and your faculties and health is starting to unravel, then to believe that I will inherit this earth renewed from the curse and it will be forevermore in the language of verse 18. But that's the faith of the believer, that's the faith of the psalmist, even in his disadvantaged position in history compared to you and me tonight. And of course it doesn't happen automatically. When the point comes and you are facing, staring death in the face, it won't suddenly kind of click into action, this faith. You have to be cultivating it now by reflecting on the greatness of the Saviour who promises to bring us back even from death. And of course, who is credible in those promises, because he himself wasn't abandoned to Sheol. He himself, on the third day, having seen no corruption, burst forth from the grave. You need to be reflecting on that constantly. That's one of the purposes of the Lord's Day, isn't it? To again drive into us resurrection faith based on the resurrection of Jesus, so that when that time comes and we're staring death in the face, we'll still have this conviction. Yes, I, though I may die very shortly, I will one day inherit the land. And perhaps finally tonight, you're not a believer at all. You're not a Christian. And you perhaps think of Christianity as a little bit silly and irrelevant and not for you. Perhaps you think it's just all about this salvation that Christians talk about. It's no big deal. It's not salvation from anything terribly meaningful. And this psalm is reminding us, no, actually this salvation that the Bible promises for those who trust in Jesus Christ, it's from the very biggest menaces and threats and troubles of all. It's salvation even from death. This salvation doesn't address our minor problems that never really bother us anyway. It addresses the problem that perhaps sometimes keeps you awake at night, the fact you're one day going to die. It even addresses that. And it says, if you're trusting in Jesus, Jesus will not merely help you through the little trials of this life, all the way my Saviour leads me, but he will help you even in the ultimate trial. Even when you've fallen down the blackest hole of all, death, he'll come for you and he'll raise you. And one day you'll inherit a new creation with him. Trust in Jesus Christ and participate in this big salvation, this colossal salvation. It's yours if you'll only come to him, even tonight. Amen.